You then move into one of the main elements of the AQUIL model, which includes quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types, and you go into lines of development for human intelligence, and you say, in the integral model, lines of development, or simply lines, refer to the various kinds of skills, traits, or intelligences that humans possess, such as math, sports, music, or connecting with the feelings of others. Out of these lines arise a multitude of passions, needs, interests, hobbies, and lifestyle choices that are important factors in your compatibility with your partner. So as we start to look at these, we start to shift from looking for there being a difference to looking towards there being similarities or compatibilities.
Correct.
Because that's what's important here.
Yes.
And you give about 24 of the various lines that I have mentioned at one point or another, and 10 of the most important are highlighted, and those include aesthetics, or what is beautiful, affect or emotion, feelings about things, cognition, awareness of what is, interpersonal capacity, interacting with others, moral ethics, what to do, needs, immediate needs for well-being, psychosexual, expression of Eros, self-identity, who are you, spiritual, what is of ultimate concern, and values, worldviews, what is important. And then you go into these facets and give the reader a chance to look at them really in a great deal of detail.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with the many facets of humanness, and you say, while the primary fantasy and opposing feminine and masculine polarities create sexual attraction and synergy, in other words, we want differences there,
mm-hmm.
couples with similar values, interests, passions, personalities, lifestyle choices, relationship skills, needs, and cultural ethnic background, which we may call gender-neutral secondary fantasies, have a higher chance of staying together. So here we're looking for similarities.
Mm-hmm.
Both sexual attraction and compatible secondary fantasies are essential for a healthy partnership. Identifying your own and your partner's passions is essential for any healthy relationship, as you either have to be able to share them, support each other in expressing them, or at the very least, be able to tolerate them.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have a section for identifying and discussing capacities, values, and ideals. And there are several dozen items that just across the board, from reading to religion, romance, sensuality, shopping, spirituality, sports, TV, it's the whole wide range.
Yeah.
But making these obvious and conscious is an important part of helping to identify a potential partner and their compatibility, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is, of course, very often a complaint of single women when they go on dates, that the males are so driven by, as Lauren Farrell says, go from eye contact to intercourse,
right,
that they often show no interest in anything else except maybe for bragging.
Right.
And I wanted to give men sort of like a list of things that they can potentially talk about before they move to the intercourse part.
Yes,
questions, you know.
And, of course, again, men's primary fantasies are essentially unchanged. They're essentially sexual and body-based,
mm-hmm.
whereas the female's primary fantasy drives her to a wider range of topics, still in the range of success, but nonetheless a wider range that even at a level of primary fantasies, she has more topics that she's going to be interested in.
That are all related to trust at the end of the day.
Exactly.
Can I trust him?
Exactly, which is an important point, which is just how important trust is for the woman. And so a man, it's not that men don't have these other interests. It's just that unless they're sort of kicked in the butt and reminded to talk about them and to put them front and center and not just sex, and they're going to have a very limited kind of conversation with their date.
Right.
So this is a little section to help get them, get their mind out of their pants, so to speak, and into other areas that they can discuss.
Correct. Talking about needs and neediness, right?
Yeah, exactly. And an important thing also that you talk about under the section opening up to feelings,
mm-hmm.
because with the recent emergence of green and pluralism and multiculturalism and sensitivity, as you point out, I think really, really well in later sections, and as we will get to, men just think that they're just supposed to be sensitive and that they're supposed to sort of just spill all of their emotions and share everything with a woman. And you point out that that's exactly sort of the wrong thing to do.
Yes.
The woman is interested in feelings, but only a certain range of feelings. Emotional intelligence is the capacity to be in touch with our own feelings and the feelings of others, and to use this information to guide our thinking and actions. Not surprisingly, almost every modern and postmodern woman says that she wants a man who is emotionally available. What she means by that is his ability to stay mentally present, or at least physically in the room, when she shares her feelings or gets emotional, that he intuitively interprets her emotional states and feelings correctly at all times, yes, even if she is ambiguous or does not verbalize them at all, and that he responds to her with kindness, empathy, compassion, and love in a reassuring way, without being condescending or trying to fix, change, or belittle her. And that's one of the primary problems of men, is their conversations are always around ways to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what a woman doesn't need or want.
Yeah.
What she doesn't mean is for him to share his own vulnerable feelings, especially if they are negative. Even worst for most women are angry emotional outbursts that mask his underlying, often unconscious, fear, hurt, shame, guilt, jealousy, neediness, or insecurity in an aggressive or passive-aggressive way. So this is something that men really need to watch. They have to be intelligent about the types of emotions that they actually share.
Mm-hmm. With their mate instead of their therapist or in their man's group.
Right. Yes, so go to their men's group and unload all of their vulnerable feelings and insecurities.
Yes.
And to, for most women, that excessive expression of vulnerabilities and weakness in a man simply cuts across not only her primary fantasy, but probably most of the stereotypes that she's picked up. No matter what they say, nonetheless, these ideas are lodged deeply in a woman, and they want a man who is essentially strong.
Mm-hmm. Strong and sensitive at the same time,
right,
to her feelings.
Right, and sensitive in that one particular kind of way.
Yes.
And so that is obviously something that most men really need coaching on, and something that they don't do well with, particularly even something like crying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the occasional woman will find that endearing, and many, many women, depending at the level of development, will
right,
secretly find it rather horrifying.
Yes. It's important to know that all these things later get put into context of vertical development, where these things shift.
Right. Yeah, exactly, and that's a good point. Thanks.
So we're not ending here.
Yeah, right. What we're talking about now are just certain basics that are given, but these change as development and different levels of consciousness emerge, and so that's important. There's another thing for men to watch out for that you point out, and that most men just trip up on, and that is when it comes to something referred to as non-violent communication. And as you point out, this way of communication is called nonviolent communication or compassionate communication. The goals of nonviolent communication are, one, to make everybody feel better after a conversation. 2, to get emotional needs, typically for understanding and connection, met. And 3, to not be attached to certain outcomes or solutions. Nonviolent communication does not judge or evaluate feelings, does not demand that people make each other feel or not feel a certain way, does not criticize others for the way they feel, and does not make people responsible for the feelings of others. This is a very feminine way of communicating that often feels inefficient and inauthentic to males because it does not get to the point, does not focus on the dialectic of good-bad, right-wrong, or win-lose, and often does not get things accomplished in an expedient manner. But the long-term benefits for partnerships are undeniable because, quote, winning the argument or, quote, being right often means losing the relationship. Nonviolent communication has not only proven to be more effective on one intimate relationships, but also in areas of modern management and politics. So that's something men really need to watch.
Yes. Is being right more important or is the relationship more important?
Right.
I have in an endnote where Robert McNamara has these 11 tenets, which I found really interesting, and one of them, he says, empathize with your enemy and rationality will not save us. So that coming from somebody like him, I found quite impressive.
Right. And there have actually been studies with women communicating, and they're supposed to communicate about how to best solve a somewhat simple chore. And men will get right to the point, talk about the chore and how to fix it, and they're out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Women will talk about it and talk about it, and instead of fixing the chore, they'll intentionally avoid fixing it so they can continue discussing it. very different mode of communicating, and of course, they're doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
Men, you know, typically in a masculine, mechanic, fix-it way, and women in a communion, a sharing, feelingful way.
Mm-hmm.
Different goals for the communication.
Yep.
So something men, doesn't come natural to men, something they need to be aware of, and something they need to practice and to learn, or they're not going to get very far in their communication skills with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
You summarize this chapter, I think, in a good way. You say, while we may love another human being unconditionally, being in a healthy partnership marriage is always based on practical conditions. It requires certain compatibilities in intelligences, passions, interests, lifestyle choices, and life purpose dreams. In other words, developmental lines.
Mm-hmm.
Many people say that they want to love and be loved unconditionally, which is possible and desirable, but romanticize this notion at the expense of practical considerations, only to realize later that their partner is too different.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, some people are so overly focused on having all the needs from their endless laundry lists exactly met that they completely miss the opportunity to learn and grow in a partnership by staying open to new possibilities and expanding their horizon. The integral relationship model considers both the spiritual and practical dimensions of love relationships equally. The desire for intimacy and to love and to be loved unconditionally, and the compatibility requirements to co-create a conditional life together.
Yes.
Well put and very true. And also, not that I want to necessarily spend all the time bashing other approaches, but it's also fairly rare to find both of these emphasized in relationship books. They usually tend to sort of specialize in one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And actually sort of give techniques to do one or the other and completely forget the importance of both.
Yeah.
We come now to levels of growth and what the integral model also refers to as altitude. And essentially, one of the things that you point out, and you do it in several different places and from several different angles, is that although all of the elements of one's so-called cosmic address, or all the elements of the integral model, including quadrants, levels, and lines, states, and types, are all important And all of them need to be taken into account for a really complete assessment of your relationship. Probably the single most important factor is the altitude. It's a person's level of consciousness, their levels of growth. If they share the same level, they pretty much got a chance, given even some significant other differences. But if they're at different levels, especially more than one level apart, then it's just not going to happen. Realistically, it's not going to happen. And as you say, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends said, until memes do us apart, will be the new wedding vow.
So here's where you first introduce the notion and start to get into it. Humans have different potentials to develop their capacities in each of the lines of development discussed in the previous chapter. This development occurs in levels or stages. Wilbur also uses the terms waves or spirals, from lowest towards highest, and may do so over a lifetime. Understanding what level of development you and your partner have reached in each of these lines and what your future growth potentials are will help you to evaluate your long-term compatibility. You point out that the number of levels given for each of the lines can vary. The granularity of simple models may be three levels, such as low, medium, and high, or pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional, while more complex models may specify 20 levels or more. The grades in our public school system provide an analogy. We could talk about three levels, elementary, middle, and high school, or we could talk about 12 levels, dividing the same span into first through 12th grade. And then there's another technical but important point. The integral model does not suggest that every human being needs to be at the highest level known to man in every line in order to be fully realized, which would be impossible anyway, as intelligences and capacities are all open-ended and continually evolve. It rather suggests that it is desirable to, one, be integrally informed about the existence of these lines, two, understand their individual significance, three, accept that lines are differently developed in people, four, recognize the potential for future growth in yourself and others, five, have a desire to foster the development of each line in yourself and others to the highest individual potential, called self-actualization. And six, balance and harmonize your development in relationship with an equal and opposite partner. And so spotting, determining one's own general level of development, as well as potential partners, is an essential part of becoming integrally informed about the relationship.
Yes, and I give a few examples like cognitive, interpersonal, emotional, kinesthetic, psychosexual, moral, spiritual, which are more pertinent to relationships, that they're well aligned.
Right, and you give some very good hints and clues on how to spot these different levels, both in yourself and in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go through consciousness development, the colors, the altitude, the basic levels. You say a key factor in creating a good relationship is to have a partner with a matching level of consciousness development.
Mm-hmm.
The fallacy of people who are critical of developmental hierarchies is to confuse natural growth hierarchies of increasing integration and complexity, which allow for more perspectives, cooperation, care, love, responsibility, creativity, and compassion, with dominator hierarchies, in which power and superiority are abused. It is therefore important to understand the difference between the two forms of hierarchies when we discuss the stages of growth and development in any of the developmental lines, so that we don't offend those who are sensitive to this issue, for example, women, or abuse our knowledge. And that's an important point about these hierarchies in general anyway. One of the things we found is that people, particularly individuals who have moved into a pluralistic or postmodern or green stage of development, are against all hierarchies totally. Mm-hmm. And what they've done is they've thrown, as Ronald Reagan would say, they've thrown the baby out with the dishes. They have failed to distinguish between these two major different types of hierarchies. Most hierarchies in nature are growth hierarchies or actualization hierarchies, things that go from like atoms to molecules to cells to organisms. And each higher level is more inclusive and more embracing, in a sense, more loving.
Mm-hmm.
Molecules don't hate atoms. Molecules don't repress atoms. They include them. They actually embrace them. And so this is a form of actualization of growth. And virtually all forms in nature go through growth hierarchies, from mm-hmm. acorns to oaks and eggs to chickens.
Mm-hmm.
But some hierarchies, individuals higher on those hierarchies or even a higher level in a single individual can abuse its power and its privilege and its increased capacities by excluding or oppressing or repressing lower levels or other individuals.
Mm-hmm.
A classic example is the caste system in India. And that, of course, is exactly the way we don't want to use these natural growth hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
We study these hierarchies and the characteristics of their different levels to help us increase communication and to help us increase understanding,
mm-hmm.
Realizing that individuals, that birds of a feather flock together, and that individuals who share a particular stage of mental growth or development are going to have an easier time communicating with each other and understanding each other and therefore relating to each other. And so it's really a tool for understanding and communication and love and compassion, and is not a tool for oppression or domination or power.
Yes, that's very important to point out. And, of course, we and you get often misunderstood.
Yes.
As we know. And I thought it was interesting that if I looked at about 200 relationship development.
Exactly. The people who say communication helps are implicitly studying people at the same level.
Right.
And communication can help.
Yeah.
And those who say, oh, communication doesn't help, they're implicitly studying people at different levels. And they're right.
Yeah.
Communication won't save you if you're at different levels.
Correct.
So it's important to have a general understanding of these levels of development, these stages of natural hierarchy, or what we call holarchies,
mm-hmm.
because it's probably the single most important rational decision that a person will make when going into a relationship. And in many cases, people will intuitively get it right, because individuals who are at green just don't share values with people that are at orange, and they don't
yes.
share values with people that are at amber.
Right.
There will be a natural antipathy. But the problem, as you point out, is that from around 3 months to 24 months, they're caught in this romantic lust phase where all of the lust hormones are up and running and,
mm-hmm.
and decommissioning the rational part of their mind.
Right, so they make babies.
That's a, so we make babies.
And for evolution, right?
Yes, exactly. We make babies and bad marriages
yeah.
at the same time.
Yes.
And so that's why it's even more important to kind of learn these levels, learn what they are, and learn what to look for in yourself and in others, and therefore at least get in the same ballpark before you let nature otherwise take over.
Yes.
So you go through, again, there can be any number of levels, and different models will work, from Robert Keegan's 5 levels to Jane Levinger's 8 levels, and we commonly use 8 or 10 in the integral model, and you go through 8 of these levels. The first, infrared, archaic, with an interest dead or alive. Second, magenta, magic, safe or unsafe. Third, red, egocentric, good or bad. Fourth, amber, mythic, right or wrong. The fifth, orange, rational, win or lose. The sixth, green, pluralistic. sensitive or indifferent, teal, integral, integrated or partial, and eight, turquoise, beginning of transpersonal, wisdom and compassion. And so you give a good overview of each of those, and there are tests that can be given, you know, for these levels, but it's unlikely that that's something you're going to be able to do or even want to do with somebody who you're just starting to date. But the most common way that we determine these levels are what's called self as instrument. And that is namely just studying the characteristics of the different levels and learning to spot them using yourself as the instrument. You simply watch and pick up and intuit and reason what qualities and characteristics this person is displaying and therefore what level they're at.
Mm-hmm. What sometimes helps me also is when I listen to somebody's history to see which levels they seem to have transcended already.
Right.
Since none of them, as you say, can be left out, right? If they never went through a certain stage, then it's unlikely that they transcended to a higher level.
Right. Right, which is a good way to use self as instrument. And again, it's just probably one of the most important factors because these different levels of consciousness are really levels of complexity in human consciousness. They're levels of the development of the mind and the tools that it has available to it. And therefore, each level has different values and different needs and different wants. And different capacity for love, and different capacity for care and compassion, different capacity for consciousness. And it just right across the board is a very, very determining factor. So spending a little bit of time studying these models of development is a very, very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, a byproduct we find is that when anybody studies any developmental map, their speed of development increases.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll have a...
Being aware of it.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it just seems... We call it psychoactive.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some good byproducts here.
Mm-hmm.